Races with Steve Beck.
We're back, second half on this Wednesday, and I mentioned as we were heading out to the break that there's going to be a news release right about now at this hour. Alex Waldrop, after a very successful tenure at NTRA, is announcing his retirement at the end of the year. He's been at NTRA 15 years, and of course, the best achievement and the one of the really important things that has been accomplished over the last few years was the the change to the withholding, gambling winnings, and I mean that as a centerpiece for his tenure. NTRA worked tirelessly to make it happen, and it's been we haven't thought much about it because it's now part of the part of the firmament. But Alex has enjoyed a really interesting and varied. I will look forward to talking to him about this. He's had an interesting and varied career. In fact, I don't know if everybody recalls or is aware that he was president of Churchill for a period, and of course has got. Is a lawyer by trade, and has got extensive experience and understanding of all the working parts around the game, around the industry. I've had so many conversations over. Really, it's the same. His tenure overlaps how long the show has been on, and we've. We've had at least one visit with Alex annually, at least, and usually more. Because there's certainly been so many different areas where NTRA has tried to help the industry, and we'll see if there's another. Role for him. There certainly, I think, will be some speculation about something else for him to do. Given the landscape that we're looking at, some very nice. I'm just reading the press release has now gone out, and here's a nice. Some very nice things. Alex was the right person at the right time to lead the NTRA, stabilize the organization, refocus its mission and core functions, and produce results that have and will continue to benefit our industry in the future. This from Alan Foreman. And of course, Alan, Alan's on the, he's one of the directors as well. Drew Fleming and Josh Rubenstein quoted as well. You're talking about things like, there's really, if you think about it, there really have been any number of initiatives. The Safety and Integrity Alliance, which, I know some people don't really know what's involved, but, the accreditation program that was put together, Steve Cook, a big, big part of that effort, and creating a set of standards and working parameters for the racetracks and things that are so behind the scenes you know, the safety rails and the alarm systems. They're just, you know, there's so many things about it that the complexity of running a business and sport. And that was an excellent response to an industry challenge, the Safety and Integrity Alliance, the NTRA Advantage. I'm just kind of skimming along here. You know, that program, again, some of this is behind the scenes that players and fans might not be aware of or, you know, understand the benefits, but, you know, that's been a big hit. NHC, of course, you know, which has grown exponentially as well. Well, we look forward to talking to Alex, and we'll see. I know that there'll be speculation about whether there's a role for Alex to play at HISA, you would imagine. And we'll see also, you know, what direction NTRA takes. I mean, certainly, you know, Keith Shamblin essentially is the general manager on a day-to-day basis and does a tremendous job too. So we'll see. We'll see where this goes. But Alex Waldrop, after 15 years, retiring from NTRA. Let's use these next couple of minutes to look ahead to the third. We're 4 minutes to post at Ascot, the Duke of Cambridge, and then we'll visit with Jamie Nicholson afterward. Let's see what we're looking at here. And Queen Power, your favorite, Sir Michael, with Silvestre D'Souza. This is the King Power Racing. Shamardal Mare. And very close second choice, Double or Bubble, 5-1. With James Doyle. And Lady Beaufort. Oh, Lady Beaufort. She was tucked up underneath there. Didn't see. 5-2 favorite, actually. 5-2 favorite. And for Kev here, he respects Lady Beaufort. Lavender's Blue, he thinks might take to the fast ground in particular. Lavender's Blue, and you're looking at 14-1. So we got a $30 player here for Kev. And also, he's interested in Posted. Lavender's Blue is the 9, and Posted is also about the same price, 13-1. This is Richard Hannon with William Buick. And this is also the spot, this was the play that Vance Hansen had interest in Valeria Messalina as well, right? That was his day two interest. The 13. There was a scratch here, so you had a 15-1 shot. Bounce the Blues, you can scratch the 5. But Champs-Élysées, 13-1, the 1 for Mr. Yoshida. Lady Beaufort, 5-2. Kieran Schomark for William Jarvis. Queen Power, as mentioned, 4-1, second choice now. Agincourt, she's been around, 6 years old. David O'Meara with Danny Tuthope, 16-1. The 6, Double or Bubble, 5-1. Forrot, the Dubawi Philly, Roger Varian, 23-1. Indy Angel, Chevrolet Park, Gosden, DeFranco, 8-1. You'd think that might be a little on those connections, a little bit of value. Dark Angel Philly, the 9, Lavender's Blue, Kev's price play, 14-1. Onassis, Irish Bred Dubawi. For Charlie Fellows, Haley Turner aboard, 19-1. Parents Prayer, the 11. Archie Watson and Holly Doyle, 10-1. There's Posted, Kev's other price play, 14-1, and Valeria Messalina, which was the idea of Vance Hansen. Let's take a look and see how close they are. They're doing some warm-ups, so we can watch for that. And I appreciate our friend Freddie that reminds me. Thanks for this, Freddie. CJ Milkowski, undergoing surgery, and of course known to you as Timeform US Figs, and best wishes to CJ. He's under the knife as we speak, so best to CJ, who so many of you know and appreciate. Jamie Nicholson after the race, and let me see what else I can tell you about this group, the Duke of Cambridge. Interesting. This also is, I'm just looking at the winner's notes. This also has got kind of a varied, horses kind of coming from many different avenues. And actually, not even necessarily coming out of wins this race. We're going to go a mile on the straight. So speed, I think that's probably the idea that Kev had here with this Lavender's Blue. He also mentions that she's got first-time cheek pieces. And that would be a fun discussion about you know, what the furry cheek pieces, what they do for a horse when they wear them. I'm gonna make a note of that. That's a fun equipment note. Cheek pieces. We don't get that. Now you see horses wearing them in the U.S., but not it's not a prominent go-to equipment change. All right, they're getting ready here to load, and no real change in the pricing. Let me get this some of this out of my way. I also do want to give you some of yesterday's other racing, including Canterbury and Indiana. The pick fives, just crazy, just paying two and three times the parlay every single day. You know, you typically just got to sniff out one or two horses in them. It's consistent value. All right, come on. They're running shockingly late. This is not usually a venue that that runs behind, but. They're actually milling, and I wonder if there's an issue here, because they are, it looks like somebody's going to get a blindfold. They're going to put the hood on one here. It looks like the five. No, it can't be the five, because the five scratched. That's the horse that scratched. Who is that they put the hood on? Here's the three, actually. Queen Power. Wow. All right. They put the blindfold, then they got the blanket. That's the other one. You know, the putting the blanket on the hindquarters. That's another stunt. To get them going. All right, now we're loading up. The Duke of Cambridge, a straight mile, and good luck to everybody in here. Here we go.
So halfway through the loading. Onassis and Champs Elysees, the next two. And that leaves four to go. Parents Prayer and Posted, Lady Beaufort and Indie Angel are the four that are out of line. Posted in, Parents Prayer likewise, the last two. Lady Beaufort and Indie Angel, they're in, set. And they're off. and a slow start from Agincourt in the Duke of Cambridge Stakes. Group two over the straight mile and starting well, Parents Prayer on the right. Near side, far side posted under William Buick up there with Double or Bubble, the terracotta jacket. Lady Beaufort away okay, the mainly purple jacket just in midfield. Valeria Messalina, the near side, followed by Champers Elise, the black and yellow stripes. Over on the far side, Furart, along with Lavender's Blue, the grey and black checks. Queen Power, India Angel and Agincourt, the back three, and just in front of those, Hayley Turner and last year's Sandringham winner Onassis. As it is, Parents Prayer and Post-it, the two disputants here, as the field have completed their first three furlongs. Heading towards halfway, Parents Prayer attempting to make all, with Post-it on the far side, Lady Beaufort and Kieran Schumach in third place, just ahead of Valeria Messalina. Double or Bubble has just dropped back to be fifth, but still close up, followed by the strong travelling Onassis, and then Champers Elise and Ben Cohen. Queen Power just getting to work now. D'Souza asking her to get a bit closer, the blue and white with Furart, Lavender's Blue, Indie Angel and Agincourt, last year's runner-up, still at the back three as they run down towards the two. And now Lady Beaufort is asked to try and mount a challenge. Onassis going well following. Parents Prayer backing out of it. Double or Bubble is trying very hard. Lavender's Blue, the far side, getting into it. Indie Angel, the near side, running home strongly for Dottori. Up for grabs, Lady Beaufort, Indie Angel and Champers Elise, the near side. Indie Angel, the near side. Over in the centre is Lady Beaufort. Champers Elise chasing hard with Queen Power. It's Indie Angel and Frankie in front here. And Indie Angel has taken the Duke of Cambridge. It's a photo for second. Queen Power and Lady Beaufort. Then Champers Elise and Lavender's Blue ahead of Furart.
Well, I'm not gonna break my arm patting myself on the back, but how do you not take an interest in Cheverly Park, John Gosden, and Frankie Dottori at 8-1? They said if you're looking for value just on connections, right? That was just obvious. Wow. Unbelievable. I'm telling you, you didn't have to be Kreskin. And I'll tell you what, Indie Angel floated up a little bit, ended up at 13-1. Didn't get any late money, and wins clear here. Wins, I mean, near side versus the far side, 8-2-3-1. Lady Beaufort, the 2-1 favorite, second in here, and Queen Power, third. Champers Elise, fourth, 8-2-3-1. And I got to tell you, the most interesting part of that call to me was a word that I've never heard used in the way in which it was used, disputants. And I got to tell you, I may not move fast enough to get to the Jockey Club, the online names book, but for $100, disputant is a really good horse name, right? Yeah, how about that? Disputant. I like that. Disputants. Indie Angel, Lady Beaufort, Queen Power, Champers Elise, 8-2-3-1 in the Duke of Cambridge. And if you're a connections player, you know, one of the great owner breeders in the sport, Cheverly Park, one of the great trainers in the game's history, John Gosden, and one of the great riders in world thoroughbred racing history, Frankie Dottori, 13-1. This is like when Seth Klarman or Peter Brandt and Chad and Irad win at you know, as the fourth or fifth choice. I don't know. I hope some people punched it up. There you go. All right, let's pause that, and we'll look ahead to today's Group 1 feature, the Prince of Wales, which is a Breeders' Cup win and you're in. And none of the ideas from from our guys came through in this spot. So we'll look ahead to the basically the more or less the second half, including the two-year-old Windsor Castle, which goes off at 12:35. The Royal Hunt Cup, which is a big fun field as well, at noon, and the Kensington Palace, a stake handicap as the nightcap. We're going to visit with Jamie Nicholson, and I owe Jamie two calls, so you're gonna get two books for the price of one with this visit. And it is summer reading season, so we're gonna have a few conversations. And last year, Jamie sent me a book just to be nice, essentially, which was his 1968, A Pivotal Moment in American Sports, and sent it with a note and said, "There's really not a lot of racing in here, but." You thought you might enjoy it. And then on its heels came Racing for America, the horse race of the century, and the redemption of a sport. It's always a pleasure to get a visit with Jamie Nicholson in. And Jamie, how are you?
I'm doing great, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. And I you know, the book is it's smaller. In fact, both of them are a really fun size, and they remind me of books I had as a kid. The punt, pass, and kick library. You know, those great running backs of the NFL. Remember those?
I do. On my parents' bookshelves. Yeah, hopefully they're readable size.
Exactly. Exactly. It you know, you can cradle it easily in one hand, which you know I like to have. I sometimes, you know, a big bulky you know, big oversized hardbound is a handful. This is actually a terrific story. Let's start with the more recent Racing for America first, because it's an obscure match race that I think as a topic is going to be new to a lot of readers.
It is. It sort of surprised me in doing the research at how big of a deal it was at the time compared to how quickly it just kind of vanished from people's memories and kind of the history of the sport. It is kind of obscure now, but at the time it was as big a deal as it was as hyped as anything in the 1920s in terms of, you know, that golden age of sport.
Well, and we're talking about Zev and Papyrus. And first of all, what even attracted you to this race?
You know, I was looking into another figure in horse racing, Edward Sims, who pops up as a minor character, and I kept coming back to his contemporary Harry Sinclair, who was running under the Rancocas stables.
Sure.
And he just seemed like a fascinating character that I wanted to know more about, and I kind of stumbled into Zev, you know, kind of through the side door. But Zev was an interesting enough horse, but this event, match race between the 1923 Kentucky Derby winner Zev and that year's Derby winner Papyrus. I said, "Well, what is this?" And it rang a bell. I was vaguely aware that this existed, but I didn't realize how important it was or how much attention it received in the newspapers, you know, not just the racing publications, but sports pages, really across the country at a time when Man of War had been an equine celebrity as well, but this was a time when racing was still kind of returning to mainstream status, and racing had been outlawed in most states the decade or two before, and so it was a big deal.
How, and of course, I mean, just the fact that you got a Derby winner versus the Derby winner, I mean, that part of it is fun and kind of a natural, but how did the two, how were they brought together? Who was the catalyst?
August Belmont seized on the opportunity to create a spectacle, a big race. Now, I think the opportunity arose because the Papyrus's owner, Benjamin Irish, an Englishman, was while hardly poor, was not necessarily welcomed or embraced in aristocratic racing circles in England, and whereas many of his contemporaries would have and did kind of look down their nose at American racing and American horses, he was intrigued by a $100,000 purse that was dangled, $20,000 to the loser, and he received some film rights. So, whereas most owners would have scoffed at the idea of putting their Derby winner on a boat to run in the dirt, and in this case, what turned out to be kind of a soupy mess at Belmont. This owner was intrigued and was roped in by August Belmont and his associates.
From that standpoint, having a Derby winner come over, and the fact that you fold in the match race scenarios, which go back, into the 1800s. I mean, the whole basis of the sport came from match racing, and these were until the end of match racing, for obvious reasons, with roughing in. And when these would come about, they did seem to come out, a lot of times organically. I mean, obviously, the War Admiral Seabiscuit match race, continues to have like a magical hold on the lore of match race history.
Right. They're interesting just as an idea, because on the one hand, right, it's kind of the, in some sense, the essence of horse racing. My horse is faster than your horse, and on the other hand, it's something different when a race with a full field has horses with different styles and different preferences, and to have just a two horse field, it removes that element. It's easier to market, like a boxing match, and the international aspect of this race was what made it unique at the time. This was the United States versus Great Britain. It was in the wake of World War I. and I go into that in the book. It's a little complicated, but the temptation for people writing about this race, American writers for sure, was to say, "All right, here's the American horse. We're gonna beat those snobby Brits, and we'll really take it to them." And they tried to put Zev in the underdog frame, which was a little bit awkward. He was very accomplished, and there was also the reality that his owner was hardly an underdog. He'd gotten extremely wealthy in oil, and was his name was starting to appear in newspaper headlines for his role in what became one of the biggest political corruption scandals of the 20th century, the Teapot Dome scandal.
Teapot Dome.
So, it took a bit of contortion to try to frame Zev in a way that would be easily embraced by Americans, but that's what happened. On the other hand, that's probably why Zev fairly soon after ceased to be a household name in American sports culture.
And that, I mean, that is kind of the back end of this. Not the epilogue, but it does go a long way, because Sinclair ended up serving time, right? He ends up in jail.
Yeah, he managed to beat the criminal charges, but ended up serving time for contempt of the Senate and contempt of court, jury tampering and stuff associated with the. With the trial, so he soon thereafter it faded out of racing, whereas you could imagine a different scenario where Zev would be remembered alongside the big names of the 1920s, but I suspect that that's just not what anybody wanted to hold up as an icon of the era.
Yeah, the race itself, and you kind of hinted at it, the backdrop that the 20s represents, and you mentioned, you know, in the teens, and I've made reference to this too, that you go back to 1908, 1909, 1910, the sport essentially ground to a halt in this country, with only two jurisdictions, you know, through the gambling blackout, only Kentucky and Maryland had any continuity in racing. And then in the aftermath of the blackout, you know, racing was trying to reestablish, and, you know, it should be noted, this is only, you know, 10, 11, 12 years later. And so when you subtitle this The Horse Race of the Century and the Redemption of a Sport, it you know, kind of comes with that. And then you also, you reference the golden age of sport, the 20s, which, you know, between Babe Ruth and Bobby Jones and Jack Dempsey and Man of War, I mean, you had a parade of just, you know, glittering sports stars. So the 20s, the roaring 20s, a big part of this, and 1923, a perfect, you know, kind of a perfect harmony to, you know, to have an event like this.
It was, and it was economically, it was the country was booming culturally. It was embracing professional sports, spectator sports, sports journalism was becoming big business. So here's an opportunity for horse racing to join that culture. But the problem was that for most of the country, there was still a stigma associated with racing, with gambling. It had been painted as something that needed to be eradicated during the progressive era and amid various reform movements. So that was why this event was, I think, so important. It didn't cause a resurgence, but it certainly accelerated it, and it made all the, this was weeks of positive exposure for the sport during the lead up as newspapers across the country were picking up these reports of how the horses were training and biographical sketches of the jockeys and the trainers and so I think it helped as groups in various states tried to get racing to return and fighting in the state legislatures over how that was going to work. A lot of these proponents of racing would say, "Oh, we're gonna have a high class sport here, and don't worry about any of that other stuff in the past. We're gonna have horses like Zev, and you remember that race? It's gonna be like that, so nothing to worry about." And it helped. I think it facilitated the rebirth of racing in the 20s and 30s.
When it came to the actual race, you mentioned that we end up not having ideal conditions. I mean, talk. I don't know if we want to. There's a lot of people that may have heard of Zevon Papyrus and the match race, but they might not know the outcome. I don't know if are we taking the drama out of it if we tell them who won or how the race unfolded.
No, I don't think so. It's kind of the race itself was rather anticlimactic. I mean, the significance is the drama is that it happened and how it came to be. But no, it was had a lot of rain in the day or two before the race, and it was the track was very sloppy. A British observer said it resembled French mustard, so that made a difficult task for Papyrus even harder. And there was some question that whether Papyrus's trainer used more appropriate shoes. Some said, "Well, it didn't matter," but that became the popular explanation was that he lost all chance because he was using smooth shoes. But he ends up losing mile and a half race. Papyrus loses by five lengths, and it really wasn't very competitive at any point, but it had attracted a big crowd. The estimates ranged wildly, but 50,000 is kind of in the middle of those, and more importantly, the crowd included a lot of influential society types, fashionable people, and the coverage of the newspaper coverage of the makeup of the crowd was helpful because the picture that reformers had painted of of racetrack racetrack characters was less than flattering, and this helped, you know, convince people that, well, maybe racing isn't so bad. There's good, respectable folk that can enjoy a horse race too. So, not spoiling the end to say that the American horse prevailed, and everybody was made headlines across the country. The British press had covered it, but covered it in a way that basically to say, can you believe these people care about this? We don't care about it at all. But some reports from London suggested that many British racing fans cared more than they would want
let
to
on.
Right.
Fold in, you know, we got to fold in two in terms of the connections, beyond Harry Sinclair and Rancocas, Sam Hildreth, the trainer, a legend in his own right, and Earl Sandy, the handy guy, as he's known, and the papyrus side of this is a little bit lesser. Certainly lesser known, and I admit to not knowing very much either there is about Benjamin Irish and Donahue.
Well, Donahue was a big name back then, and he was known to British race fans by his first name. I mean, like Magic or Michael. He was just staying there, and Papyrus' trainer was Basil Jarvis, who came from a family of trainers, and I believe that family is still active on the British turf, and. Yes, connections. Yeah, they were. Sandy was coming into his own as the top young rider in America, kind of a budding celebrity athlete in his own right, and Hildreth was certainly well known. I mean, these were big names that helped add to both the significance of the race and made it easier to hype.
Yeah, and the fact that, as you reference, that Zev doesn't necessarily hold the same historic gravitas as well, certainly as Man of War or even some of the other era Gallant Fox and I suppose obviously the Triple Crown winners of the era, but he was terrific and had a real terrific career. I mean, as a 2, 3, and 4 year old.
He did. He won the Kentucky Derby, won the Belmont. He the Preakness was held before the Derby that year, and he was kicked at the starting line, and he was subsequently kind of dismissed by. Betters in the Derby because he didn't do anything in the Preakness, but he was fast and could carry the speed. He was a serious horse. I don't know if he didn't reproduce his class as a stud, and maybe that hurt him in in people's historical memory. I don't know.
He, for those that don't know the record, you know, he's a Hall of Famer, we should mention. for those that don't realize that we're talking about a Hall of Famer in Zeff, and he was by the Fin. He went 23 for 43 in his career, and as a two-year-old, people will get a kick out of this with Saratoga, you know, now within eyeshot. He ran 7 times as a two-year-old at Saratoga, which is just nuts. And the weather was dreadful that summer, boy, because he was on heavy going all except for, well, there was one good and one fast, but otherwise 5 starts over the heavy going. So it was a rainy summer, and it took him 2 starts at Saratoga to break his maiden. He had been unable to break his maiden downstate in June and July. He was 0-4. Breaks his maiden in his second start with Earl Sandy. Then he wins a couple of allowances. Then he wins the Grand Union Hotel, the Albany. He was 3rd in the hopeful, and then back downstate for the Futurity to end his two-year-old year. He ended up 2nd. But you know, you win the Albany and the Grand Union at that time was a big race, and the Grand Union Hotel Stakes was big two-year-old stake. So not as big as the hopeful, but that's a nice win. And then as a three-year-old, as you mentioned, went on a strong run. I mean, after that Preakness, he wins the Rainbow, the Derby, the Withers, the Belmont, the Queens County, an allowance. Then he wins the Lawrence Realization, which was a big race. He wins the Match Race. He wins the Autumn Championship at Empire City. And then a couple other things near the end of the year. And then has another Match Race, which is even more obscure.
Yeah, and you mentioned the mud. It was he was winning in the mud as a 2-year-old, and kind of people dismiss him and say, "Oh, he's just a mudder, just a sprinter." But and they keep saying that through his 3-year-old year, and finally wins the Belmont, wins the Realization, and yeah, it was the Match Race at the end of the year. Is a interesting kind of side story that he wins the race of the century against the Pirates. And some people are saying, "Well, okay, so he's won the, but what about Admiral Grayson's horse called My Own? He still needs to win the American Championship." There'd been some controversy over whether it should be Zev as the American entrant into the international, and that's a side story. But so they're going to settle American 3-year-old championship honors at Latonia after the international race, and a local horse named In Memoriam wins that, and so then they have another Match Race between Zev and In Memoriam to settle American 3-year-old champion honors. That was at Churchill Down, that some journalists had the audacity to call that the race of the century just weeks after the last one.
the fact that they needed to create that race to decide the 3-year-old championship after the season that Zev had is a little it's a little silly, it seems. I mean, right? I don't get. I
well, I think it's an illustration of how racetracks were seeking any opportunity to host and promote a big event, and it does. It was it it was silly, but at the time, and I suppose the people covering the sport, the controversy sells newspapers and showdowns brings people to the racetrack. But yeah, from the perspective of 100 years later, you're looking back and saying, well, this is silly. How could anybody take this seriously? But they did.
And it's funny, In Memoriam ends up matching up with Zev, but the clamor actually was for the horse that might have, had there been an issue in the international match, if there had been any issue with Zev, My Own would have substituted, and there were people that wanted to see a match race between Zev and My Own.
Yeah, and that was. They said, okay, we'll settle this. That was the race at Latonya, and My Own was well beaten. So they said, okay, he's clearly not the right. Zev was the right horse to face the Epsom Derby winner. Shouldn't have been My Own, but now we'll settle. Now we'll really settle the championship. But My Own was part of the story in the international race, because he was selected. Much of the frustration of his owner, Admiral Kerry Grayson, he was the first alternate, and a couple of days before the race, August Belmont sent a telegram, said, quick, send My Own north. He was in Maryland. I might have a problem with Zev. He has a rash, and this got picked up on all the news, the wires, and it, cynics said this was just to create more drama and more attention, and so he sent his horse up, and they said, okay, well, never mind. But they didn't. Grayson said that he wasn't notified that his horse would actually not be running, and so he was on the train and got to the track with his guests, to include President Wilson's widow, ready to see his horse run, and they were disappointed. So it was a circus, but that was kind of part of the point, kind of part of the benefit of this event was a lot of ink was devoted to the story.
Jamie Nicholson's with us, and Jamie, let's listen in. We're going to pick up. They've just sprung the latch, and the Prince of Wales, they're going to go a mile and a quarter, and I can tell everybody, love the Aidan O'Brien Galileo filly for Coolmore, of course, is the heavy favorite. 1-2 in here. Audaria, who, of course, coming out of Breeders' Cup, 9-2. Third choice, because Armory, the other Aidan O'Brien with Heffernan, is 7-2. And Sangarius, who there's a little bit of affection for in quarters, looking for a price, 16-1. Let's pick up the the Prince of Wales, today's Group 1.
Behind his stable companion and Desert Encounter in the hood is still last of the six as they run past the half-mile marker here. About six or seven lengths first to last, and Love has the lead to My Oberon in second, Sangarius, Audaria still in fourth. No move yet from Armory in fifth place, and Desert Encounter just pushed along last of the six as Love leads them inside the three and on the turn for home. Love in front, Sangarius, Audaria is mounting a challenge on the outside. Ryan Moore gives Love a squeeze, asks it a stretch. Sangarius, Audaria, Armory's just tucked in behind Audaria. Love with the advantage. She's going to have to fight hard. She does respond. Audaria in second place, laying down a big challenge. Armory to the outside. Then My Oberon, Sangarius has wilted. Love is very tenacious. Audaria won't give in, but Love finding plenty for Ryan Moore. Armory is in third, and Love is coming up to the line. She sends Ascot head over heels. A special filly has won. Love
makes all and very tough in the Prince of Wales' stakes to Ordaria. A terrific race between the two of them. Armory next, and then My Oberon, Desert Encounter, and Sangarius.
Well, there was mid stretch. There was a little bit of a question whether Ordaria might in fact collar Love, but with every challenge, with any time that Ordaria seemed to be drawing even, Ryan Moore able to extract a little bit more out of Love, and the Galileo filly takes down the Prince of Wales. Very nice. There's your action. 7-6-1-4 in a formful edition of the Group 1 Prince of Wales. Jamie Nicholson's with us. We're talking about his latest book, Racing for America, the Horse Race of the Century and the Redemption of a Sport, the story of the Zeb Papyrus match race at Belmont, and an international sensation. And I've got to read one little thing. I'm sure Jamie would love to have written this, but it's famously attributed to Damon Runyon. And I mentioned earlier about Earl Sandy being a handy guy. Well, the poem for those, the couplet, if you've never heard it: why do you ask who won it? Zev had Sandy up, and Sandy can ride for money or marbles or golden cups. Steakhouse or selling plater, say when I want to win. Give me a handy guy like Sandy booting them horses in. And it doesn't get better than that when you want to have a sports writer give you a moniker for the rest of your career, a handy guy. And there it is. Really fun. Jamie, in addition to Racing for America, and I wanted to also include, and I put up the link for people to order it directly from University of Kentucky Press. And it's going to be a busy summer because, of course, we had Lenny the last couple of weeks, and Lenny's book, Face to Face, his conversations, his collection of conversations, also coming out from University of Kentucky Press. But in addition to this book, Jamie, talk a little bit about 1968, a pivotal moment in American sports. And this is a little bit older, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it when it came out the previous year.
Well, yeah, there is a little bit of horse racing in there, specifically the Dancer's Image Kentucky Derby, but it's more of a look at the American sports scene more broadly, and how the discord of the late 60s in America was playing out on fields of play in the major sports events of the year. You had a disqualification in the Masters, and in the Kentucky Derby you had controversy at the World Series with an unusual rendition of the national anthem.
That's right.
This was when Muhammad Ali was appealing his suspension and his he was out of the sport for the draft situation. So it was. And it's a couple of years old, but I was interested in, we were kind of seeing some similar themes in present day in terms of how sports are being politicized. And I was curious to see how at a pivotal moment in American sports and American society and American politics, how all that was was playing out then.
The chapters, broken out into five chapters, but the illustrations listing, it just gives you a snapshot of, just what a tumultuous year it was. And the way, in fact, you've got this laid out where there's the sporting event and then intermixed with the societal unrest, and the unrest just kept coming. And it's funny, it starts with the Ice Bowl, and then the war, and George Wallace and the University of Alabama, the Civil Rights Act, Ali Liston. You mentioned the Masters, Roberto DiVincenzo with the scorecard. Then came the Derby, Bobby Kennedy's assassination. It's just unbelievable. Chicago and the DNC and everything that went on. It's just amazing. I mean, when you think about the layer upon layer of storylines, Feliciano, I think that gets lost in everything. Until you brought it up, not even something I would have associated. Tommy Smith and John Carlos, mm-hmm. and the Olympic podium, and the Black Power salute. It's unbelievable. I mean, this was Kurt Flood, Joe Namath. I mean, it's aptly named, Jamie, a pivotal moment in American sports, 1968. And I hope that we alert some people to it, because it's amazing what you wove together here.
Well, thank you. When you list them all together, it is remarkable that was one year in history. Growing up, I looked back at reading about the listening to the music of the 60s, and I would think, that seemed like interesting times. I wonder what it would be like to live in interesting times. I now know what it's like to live in interesting times, and maybe it's more fun to read about than to experience. But I really did enjoy that writing that book and doing the research.
You're how old? Because I think you're younger.
I'm a 1978 model. I'll be 43 in September.
All right. Well, having been just old enough, I was 8 going on 9, just old enough to remember virtually all of this, including our neighbor, Len Cedar, who was had been with Bobby Kennedy on the campaign and had. It's just for those that that hear these things and they see mostly black and white images, you really wouldn't have believed it. It's just an amazing and things like the Sporting News or Sports Illustrated. Coming every week and reading about the these events, and we didn't have we certainly didn't have the kinds of accessibility that you have now. I mean, you had three channels of television and maybe a grainy fourth on UHF, and the way in which all of this was delivered and to you. Nightly news, everybody, basically watching, whether it was Huntley and Brinkley or Walter Cronkite. I mean, it was just, it was a much different focus. I think this book deserves order. Obviously, folks, order them together is what I'm trying to tell you. 1968 by James Nicholson, Jamie Nicholson, and Racing for America. What's next, by the way, for you? What are you working on now?
I started to look at Old Rosebud.
Ooh.
Won the Kentucky Derby in the early 20th century and was injured in his next race. He was turned out for 2.5 years and then returned to be the top older horse in America. But it sure seems like it would lend itself to a book. But I haven't quite figured out how to make the pieces fit, so we shall see.
Well, you know, it, Old Rosebud is a great it's amazing that you're attracted to these kinds of stories, actually, because he also was a was heralded and was a big story. And we also, we don't, for whatever reason, we stopped calling horses things like this, nobody names a horse these days, Old Latruska. we don't get that same, and we don't get enough in America anyway. We don't get enough horses named the something. I like that. I like when a horse is. I like that use.
There are plenty of colorful names out there, but no, the ones from yesteryear, some seem a little more special.
Well, Jamie, whatever you've worked on over the years, I've always found engaging, and I did not want to be too far away from the release of Racing for America. Didn't want it to get too far away. Wanted to get you on, and I appreciate you sending it and invite people, anybody that has got a summer reading list. Put it on, and while you're ordering, 1968, a pivotal moment in American sports as well, and Lenny's book too, Face to Face. We'll talk to Lenny probably next week before we go on vacation. Lenny's going to come in and talk about his book, so order all of them together.
Yes, please. Thanks, Steve. I really appreciate you having me on and your support of authors and books in general. It's for some people, history doesn't matter of the sport, but for some people, it's part of the essence of the sport. And I really appreciate your support.
Not at all. And to me, the University Press of Kentucky, a big part of this story, because their willingness to support particularly equine titles and support authors that are addressing not just equine sport, not just sport in general, but all kinds of titles. And for those that have never been to the website, absolute, you're going to end up, if you like to order books, if you like to have books in the house, you'll end up ordering dozens, because it's KentuckyPress.com, by the way, and go through their catalog. Go through their, every 6 months or so or a year, I'll go through the clearance bin and find three or four things to order. It's funny how many topics University Press, how many titles they send out that I love, and of course equine being first, very big with Hollywood. There's lots of Hollywood and filmmaking storylines, and then food, the tremendous amount of food, and then things you didn't really know, stories you never even heard of. I'll give you an example. When I was going through, this must have been, I don't know, 6 or 8 months ago, the Marion Miley story.
Right.
I had never, I'm a golf fan. I'm fascinated, you know, sports history. I had never heard of Marion Miley. And it is unbelievable that, and this is, am I wrong, or is this a story that that has not gotten nearly the attention that it probably should, either a movie or a documentary, maybe there is, that I'm just not familiar, but there was a book by Beverly Bell, The Murder of Marion Miley, who was as big a female golf star in the late 30s and early 40s, I mean, the likes of Babe Zaharias and Louis Suggs, and she was murdered at the country club where she and her mother lived in Lexington. It was a huge story at the time, and nobody knows about it.
No, and not even really around here. I was familiar with it. You know, people would sort of mumble, yeah, you know, that's where that lady was killed, the story's remarkable. It ought to be a movie.
And she was, she was a huge talent. It's while you're at University Press, order The Murder of Marion Miley by Beverly Bell. So by the time you're done here, you're gonna need to build bookshelves by the time I'm through with you. Jamie, this was great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve. Really appreciate
always,
it.
Always a pleasure. James Nicholson. His latest. We've got Seth Merrow standing by, listening in. I think. Seth? No? Case? Pick up on Seth? Clean up on... Oh, you lost him. Okay, you lost Seth. All right, he's going to get Seth back. Both of these books, 1968 and Racing for America. I would get it on your summer reading list. Now I think I hear Seth Merrow.
Yes. Just as you introduced me, the line went dead.
Of course.
Maybe that's a hint.
Not a hint. Not at all. Are you banging it at Royal Ascot?
I'm watching. Certainly, yeah. It's become fun over the last few years with. Wesley Ward going over and John Velasquez being over there. That makes it more fun. I mean, it was always, is there more of a quality meet in the world that packed into 5 days like that? So it's always fun to watch, certainly.
Well, we're about 18 minutes to the fifth race, and quick glance here for folks. We're going to send you off into the afternoon. I've got to run to Bennington. So I will be watching and wagering on the phone. This is weird. I got the sixth and I've got the seventh. Where did the fifth go? And I will remind people that in the sixth, that's the Windsor Castle at 12:35. And you've got the two Wesleys. Wesley will try to get one and probably one of his best chances of the week, Ruthin, the 28th. In the Windsor Castle with Dottori and Johnny aboard Golden Bell, the Macho Uno filly, the 26. So we got another chance, but terrific for Aaron Wellman and the team from Eclipse Thoroughbred. They must have absolutely had this in mind. I'll probably try to get Aaron on tomorrow. To celebrate, but they must have, you know, the idea must have been to campaign a 2-year-old in Europe for this opportunity.
And look at the size of these fields, both of these next two races.
Yeah.
These are absolute cavalry charges. So if you are betting into Royal Ascot, these are the kind that make your mouth water because you have some opportunities. This upcoming fifth, the two looks a little bit interesting. Hikwiki, I'm guessing perhaps. Gosden horse, maybe a little bit of a price. I don't have the live odds in front of me, but 7-1 on the morning line. But I thought that one might be a little bit interesting.
Well, I can tell you exactly what's going on that front. And Hikwiki, which is right at a glance, had to be a Shadwell horse, and it is. Gosden and Crowley, 13-1. And actually, that's twice the morning line price. This is a group, the Royal Hunt Cup. They're going to go a mile, and you're looking at a field of 30. So, yeah, 30 of them in here, and cavalry charge indeed. Let me give you Kev's opinion. He's interested in, he's got four horses that he is going to give you some attention. The 16, Finest Sound, the 9, Grove Ferry, the 27, Revich, and the 3, Bowerman. Those are the horses in a big bulky field that Kev is interested in. And let's get you some pricing. 16, 9, 27, and 3. So we'll give it to you in numerical order. Bowerman is 59-1, a Dutch Art 7-year-old. Grove Ferry, 18-1 for Andrew Balding, who, of course, won yesterday. David Probert takes the call, 18-1 on this Ex-Celebration 4-year-old. Then out to Finest Sound, 13-1, Simon Crisford for a Maktoum family charge, an Exceed and Excel 4-year-old, 13-1. And then out to the 27, Revich, 65-1, Richard Spencer and Haley Turner. So if you can swinger these together, exacta them together, something, or just bet them each way, you got some nice numbers here in the Royal Hunt Cup coming up at noon. And speaking of which, Seth, why can't we get the swinger bet here in North America? Got to get that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, I would think there's no reason why, other than the powers that be are reluctant to do it for one reason or another. But if it's available one place, it certainly technologically is doable.
Well, and Naira reached for approvals at the time to the Racing and Wagering Board, and we thought, you know, we thought it was going to happen. To me, it's a very effective introductory bet for people that get frustrated. They don't understand, you know, if they go bet an exacta, they're a new bettor. I learned all this from Tina as a mutual clerk. And, you know, she said people would come up with a ticket and they see their number on the board, and particularly if they have a winner, and then another horse finished third, and they don't understand, didn't I hit the exacta? Well, no, you needed to be first and second. Well, the swinger would be also known as an omni, would be such a painless way for new players to get introduced to multi-horse wagers. And they can finish first, second, second, third.
When you parse it out to new players, because when we're in the game long enough, we lose that perspective. Because almost every summer, not last summer, but almost every summer, I'll bring a few new people to the track. And it is eye-opening to see how excited they are to win $3.20.
Right.
And you have to, like, readjust, and that's how people get excited about the game. And so you point these newbies in different directions. And it's also fun to realize, I mean, I don't really play it anymore. Every once in a while I'll look to see how it compares with an exacta, but I don't play the Quinella anymore. But that might be a bet that more tracks may want to look at a little bit to bring new people into the game too, because at that point, you know, you either number, either way, you're good to go. So for the new folks, that may be a little bit easier to understand.
Well, and speaking of new players coming to Saratoga potentially this summer, Dave Grenick in the last half hour reporting Saratoga will be open at 100% capacity. And nice news there, and also good news on the Belmont side. And in fact, I was waiting to get some information, so good to see this, because somebody wrote to me with this question. Belmont Park general admission walk up $5 resumes June 24th, so no more special arrangements to get in and all that. $5 general admission walk up sales starts on the 24th, next Thursday.
Yeah, you could see it coming. I mean, last week the governor kind of hinted at it when he said we're shooting for 70%, and when we get there, we'll ease the restrictions, and that's essentially what happened yesterday. So it pretty much every place is gone. You know, you still, I know, bouncing around. I was in a restaurant yesterday that still had a mask sign up. Oh, I was in the post office, and they have something that says, you know, we have federal rules, so please wear your mask. So there are still those locations, but the state in general has kind of taken the restrictions off as we hit the 70% vaccine mark yesterday.
Well, that was what we were looking for, right? That was the magic number?
Absolutely, yeah, which I think is, you know, the scientific kind of herd immunity type of a thing. And they pointed at various zip codes around the state that haven't quite gotten there yet, but I think upstate has been doing pretty well vaccine-wise. Right along, and so that plays into Saratoga certainly.
Well, this is all, you know, it's funny. It's come to hand. You know, we kept saying moving in the right direction, moving in the right, and now all of a sudden, you know, it's nice to get out of the car, go to the grocery store, and not, you know, realize three steps away from the car, ugh, forgot my mask. It's like you have to relearn. There's all these habits and practices that, you know, that have been adjusted, right, in your lifestyle, and now you don't have to think them through like you were.
You are absolutely right, and I've heard that from a bunch of people who are like, man, now I got to get used to not wearing the mask. For me, it was pretty easy. I did not like the mask at all, so I was right into that. But it's funny, you talk about the supermarket. I laughed the other day. I'm walking down the aisle, and I'm looking for the arrow. Am I going the right way in the lane? But they've done away with the one-way streets in the supermarket.
That's a good point. I wasn't good with that either. I would look down,
and if nobody was in the lane, I'd go the wrong way.
Well, see, I'm one of these shoppers. I will park my cart at the end cap, and particularly if I know what I'm going in the aisle for is in, let's say, the first 20%, maybe 30% of the aisle on either side, and so I park the cart up against the end cap, and I just dash down, grab what I want, and go back and you know, resume my shopping. But I'm a notorious cart parker. I'm the guy that people see the cart sitting there, and they're like, what asshole did this? It's me.
The person everybody's pointing at.
Well, I don't know if you saw my tweet the other day. I pointed at somebody else. How about the people? Who are these people? do a little
that was
Jerry.
Pretty good. That was pretty good.
Thank you. I took a picture. I put this up on Twitter with a snapshot from Slapshot, where somebody had taken a cart and a shopping cart, and literally the first spot in the parking lot, Seth, closest to the store, and there's the berm where they've got shrubbery, and there's the berm, and, you know, right across, there's the grocery store. They had taken their shopping cart and put the front wheels up on the berm. I mean, you're so lazy, you can't take that cart and put it up on with the other carts that was literally 22 feet away. Instead, you left a metal obstacle in the way of drivers because you couldn't push the cart. Nothing makes me crazier than that.
Don't get me started on the supermarket, because supermarket is my nemesis. My brother used to call them the oblivions, people who are just oblivious to everybody else. And supermarkets seem to attract them.
Well, now Casey's making me feel bad. Casey's saying, maybe, what if they were handicapped? All right. I'm sorry. Jeez. I don't know. I put up the picture of Denny. What's the goalie's name in Slapshot? Denny. When he's on the show and he says, you go to the box by yourself. 2 minutes, you feel shame. That's I put that picture up, with the cart. I'm going to say, Casey, that these are not handicapped people, because I see it's one thing. I guess that is close to the handicapped spaces. Well, listen, this is a whole nother segment. I mean, Seth, we could do a segment on this. I mean, my favorite are the people that pull into the handicap slot. They reach down to their glove box and they hang a tag up and they jump out of the car and walk in. It's like, whoa, wait a minute.
One of my best oblivions story was I'm five deep in the self in the service desk line at the supermarket. And the woman at the desk, the person handling the desk, is facing the other way. She's at a counter in the back, not looking at the people in line. And like I say, I'm five deep. And so at one point, I leaned forward and to address the four people ahead of me and said, is she waiting on any of you? And they all, as typical, get a little bit upset. Oh, somebody's in it. And then it dawns on them, oh, this guy's going to say something. So they're all like, no, no, no. And they all stand there and wait for me, the fifth guy in line, they would have been there for the rest of the day. I had to say, excuse me, you got five people here waiting for you, for her to turn around and realize there were people waiting. The other four people would have done nothing. But even when I said something, they were more than happy to, no, you go ahead. You say something. Like, oh, come on.
Unbelievable. Well,
no, because they're going into the gate. But when you mentioned a movie, and we have Royal Ascot, I will tout people.
Ooh.
If they haven't watched, I have people tout to me for months now. Check out Ted Lasso. I binged it last week. If folks haven't seen it yet, three thumbs up. It's definitely a very Frank Capra-esque kind of for the 21st century. Feel good, and it's the first season, 10 episodes, and I think the second season is going to start, but it's very, very good. Ted Lasso, Apple TV.
Well, this is the Jason Sudeikis as a football coach who gets hired to coach a soccer team in the UK, right? That's the
right. I was tying it into a little Royal Ascot, and you mentioned a movie, so I thought perfect timing. But yeah, you got it. You nailed it.
We should watch it. My problem is I got Tina. Tina wrote me into rewatching every season of The Mentalist. Literally watched seven seasons of The Mentalist, and which I liked. But I'm sort of surprised that we just spent 10 days or whatever it was. Every time I walk in, she's watching an old episode of The Mentalist. Simon Baker, who isn't he a Breeders' Cup ambassador?
I don't know. I think he is. In my head, but I'm not familiar.
I think he is. Yes. He is. He plays the cat also in the wonderful. Oh my God! With the send up of Vogue of Devil Wears Prada as well. Seth, we've run out of time. I'm talking about nothing, which another Seinfeld reference. As only you and I can, but not only you and I can do. I've been doing it for 15 years. What you got? Did you play in it? You got one horse today somewhere?
I'll toss out one at Delaware. Just if the morning line holds up, and with the 6-horse field, I'm not sure. But the 9th at Delaware today, the 6, Hope Has a Name, is 6-1. The favorite is going to be Cuz I Said, but I think Hope Has a Name has a little edge in there. So race number 9 at Delaware, number 6, Hope Has a Name. 6-1 on the morning line. We'll see if that holds.
Seth Merrow, everybody. I like it. Hope Has a Name. That's a good name in and of itself. The 6, you get Charlie Marquez with Hugh McMahon. Thank you, Seth Merrow.
Good luck to everybody today.
Hey now, Seth Merrow, folks. We're a minute from post. And then I got to run to Bennington. And I want to thank Seth and Jamie Nicholson. Really nice conversation with Jamie about Zevin Papyrus. Claudia Rubstein with the big day at Fort Erie yesterday. Sid Fernando, Sire Watch, Better Refocus, brought to you by Hillendale. And Pete as well. Thanks, everybody. Good luck today. Talk to you in the morning.
Let the summertime song. Fall on the apple.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product.